Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Yes, hello out there, everyone, and welcome back to None But the Brave, a presentation of Evergreen Podcasts. I am Hal Schwartz, and as always, I'm here with my great buddy, Flynn McClain, and I think we've got a really interesting episode for everyone tonight. Joining us shortly will be Cliff B. He is one of the original Springsteen tapers. He first saw Bruce in 1974. He was at the Bottom Line in 1975. He was also at the Roxy that year. He was at the Boston Music Hall shows in 1977. This gentleman has seen it all, and he has some amazing stories.
Oh, absolutely. You may not know his name, but you know his work. He did a great service to so many Springsteen fans over the years. He had no idea what he was doing at the time, that he would be sharing these and preserving these amazing shows, but he did, and we're extremely appreciative.
Yes, we really are. And with that, we want to get right to it. So Flynn will introduce our guest tonight.
He's been seeing Bruce since 1974. His first show was actually the Ann Murray incident, I'm sure many of our listeners are familiar with. And we'd like to introduce Cliff to the podcast. Thank you for joining us.
Glad to be here.
This is really a pleasure for us, and we're really fascinated by some of the things you were telling us before we started, and now we'll talk about for the audience. I wanted to start by asking, you saw your first show in 1974. Obviously, Bruce was not a big name yet at that point. How did you discover him, and what brought you to his music?
I saw Steve Simel's review of Greetings in Stereo Review. It was named one of the albums of the year in 1973. I wrote it down on a yellow pad to make sure I went out and found a copy, and went to a department store that weekend, found a copy under the S miscellaneous section, since Springsteen didn't have his own labeled LP section. I'm probably now leaving people under 50 years old in the dust going, what's he talking about? Found the record, fell in love with it, grabbed Wild and Innocent as soon as it came out, made a cassette for the car, and played it nonstop through 1974. And, went to see Bruce at Central Park in the Schaefer Music Festival. I think I had probably 8 tickets. It was one of those things where I told my friends, you got to see him, And if you don't like it, you don't have to pay for the ticket. But everybody liked it. Brewer and Shipley opened, then Bruce came on. That's a whole story. I won't get into it. It's been documented. And then, Bruce did an abbreviated set. Didn't start with Incident. I think he finished with Kiddies and did an encore of Rosalita. And then somebody came out and announced, as we're all kind of just getting over the experience of Bruce, Ann Murray will be out in 15 minutes. And boy, people started booing and people started leaving. And my best recollection, which I've confirmed with a few of the friends of mine that were at the show, is 3/4 of the people left.
That is, of course, a very famous story. And she had actually argued to go on, according to Bruce Bass, as the headliner because she said, I'm bigger than this guy. She'd never heard of who Bruce was. And that backfired really badly on her. Now,
yeah. I've read that it was her management. She was managed by Shep Gordon, who there's a phenomenal documentary about him called Supermensch. But, he had a local guy that was kind of, I heard, pushing the show hadn't sold out, and therefore she should be the main act since she had the hit.
Yeah, that did not work out too well for her. So did you stick around for her set?
No. Okay. We were in the group of people that were marching out.
Wow. Well, now you also saw two more shows in 74. You saw Avery Fisher. And the thing about that one is that there was a stage collapse. Now, you were there.
We were right there. We were sitting about 20 rows back on the aisle on the left side with Clarence in front of us. And either when Sandy started or Quarter of the Three started, we rushed up to the stage. So we were, you know, two or three people deep at the stage when all of a sudden the speakers on the left side collapsed. And the two rows of seats right next to me, the people were gone. They all dropped 6 feet. There was a temporary floor there where there were a couple of rows of seats that just the people went down. And, you know, obviously nobody seemed to be hurt. And then if you listen to the tape of that show, you can hear at the end of Quarter to Three, somebody coming out and saying, please move to the back of the auditorium. Please move to the back. And that's because they were, you know, going to try to make sure they could get people out of the hole they were in.
Did Bruce have any reaction or any band members look at it and go?
I don't think they knew what was going on. I think I had written maybe Bruce Space that they abruptly ended Quarter to Three, but I have since checked and there wasn't any kind of abrupt ending, and it was actually a fairly lengthy Quarter to Three for that period of time.
I didn't see Bruce until 1984, and Flynn didn't see him until 88. I'm guessing a lot of our listeners probably saw him the earliest on the River Tour and most later than that. So I think what we're all wondering is, what was it like to be in the room with this young, scrawny guy on stage? You even saw the band with Boom Carter and David Sanctius. What was it like to see this band and experience what you did at these shows?
Yeah, you know, Central Park was the first time, didn't know what to expect. Just, you know, thought it was a great show. There's no set list. There are no tapes because my friend Joe's VW Beatle broke down. Otherwise, he would have recorded that show, but it never got recorded. So it's hard to say. I do remember, though, there's only a few songs that I heard in my lifetime, the first time that just stuck in my head. And at that show, it was Jungle Land. Just had never heard anything like it. Called my friend at Columbia Records, worked in the accounting department there the next day, and said, we saw Bruce last night. He did this song called Jungle Land. It's unbelievable, you know? Avery Fisher was the first time, with Bruce coming out with Suki on stage in a long white dress with the violin and opened incident, you know, with Roy was on piano that night and, you know, started in and then Suki hit the violin and then Bruce, I seem to remember having a white sleeveless t-shirt on and shades. And it just, that was magical. So I mean, that show just was like nothing I had seen. And then the show that, you know, I'm probably maybe the one that got quoted as saying the greatest show of all time. And I still can't say it was Westbury Music Fair in 75 with the rotating stage and, you know, Bruce doing the full set with, Jungle Land, Kitty's Back End, New York City Serenade, each one being 15, 20 minutes long. And that's when it hit me like, okay, this is the best thing I've ever seen.
At that point, Bruce's career was kind of hanging in the balance at Columbia in terms of the record sales weren't doing well. And he was the third album was a make or break moment for him.
Right.
Could you kind of feel that going into 75, and especially when you hit when the bottom line stand began?
Yeah, certainly not at Westbury. You know, Bruce just seemed to be having a ball. The bottom line was, I had seen Providence before that. That was a big disappointment when there was no Suki and none of those three epic songs were played. But that may have had something to do with it being outside as well. But for the bottom line, you know, it was people that had seen him before lined up. You know, at the bottom line, you lined up outside. It was staying, first come, first serve on the seating. So, I don't think anybody had that feeling. I don't think anybody knew that Bruce was under any kind of pressure. And, you know, the bottom line was just people were excited. And then the last two nights after the radio broadcast, it was big time excitement for the Saturday and Sunday lineup at the bottom line, you know, where there was a standing room line across 4th Street, you know, that might have been 10 or 15 people deep the first few nights. Saturday and Sunday, it was 30, 40 people at least, I would say. Just, you know, with the hope of trying to get in for part of the show.
How many of the bottom line shows were you lucky enough to see?
Five.
Wow.
And were you at the broadcast?
No. We were, we had tickets for the late show that night. So I started recording it on my home recorder. I only got a call the afternoon to tell me, hey, do you know Bruce is on the radio tonight? And I said, I didn't know that. So I set up my home recorder with a 45-minute cassette in it and then called my sister-in-law, who luckily had a Nakamichi tape deck, so she had good equipment. And I said, hey, Bruce is going to be on tonight. Can you record starting, you know, 45 minutes into the show or half? Actually, I think I asked her to record, I think I may have been home for the first 45 minutes, then flipped the tape and then told her to get started. But luckily, we both recorded all of the commentary before and after the show, because I think those are the only recordings that exist of that commentary. I don't think the station copy that has since come out, which is by far the best quality recording, I don't think the station copy had all the commentary. But luckily, the tape my sister-in-law made played all the way through Allison Steele, the Nightbird, you know, coming on after the guys at the NEW had signed off.
Yeah, and the comments that Bruce had afterwards, where you're talking about being a, like he was a prize fighter. That's that's pretty fun to listen to, and it's I feel like it's been lost over the years.
And Dave Herman couldn't get his name straight.
Flynn mentioned that Bruce was under immense pressure with the label after those first two records, and obviously, we know the recording of Born to Run was really hard on him. So he had been through a lot that year. Did you sense a difference watching his performance in terms of his confidence level than you had seen in 74?
Probably a little bit. Yeah, he grew professionally. They all grew. You know, the bottom line is a fairly small stage, but Bruce managed to still be pretty active and jumping around and getting on top of the piano and doing some mugging behind the cast iron pole columns that were on the stage. So he was having a lot of fun with it.
Now, what was it like to see Bruce explode the way he did in 75 after you were basically one of the first fans to really get into him?
Oh, it was great. You know, after that, we were lucky enough to, I get to see him in the homecoming show in Red Bank. I got a call from that friend of mine, Joe, who's a legendary collector of Bruce recordings, that they had just announced the show in Red Bank, New Jersey for the next night, and I wanted to come with him. So I got to go to that show, and that was, Bruce was just on fire, being at home before going out to Los Angeles to try to make the West Coast people, learn who he was. So that was incredible. But, you know, we then went to all five of the shows at the Roxy.
Incredible.
And saw those. And that was just, you know, that was one of the best decisions I ever made. And, you know, didn't have Ticketmaster or anything on the internet back then. So, you know, I called the Roxy to find out if they had any tickets, you know, how I could do it. And there was a limit of two tickets per customer. And she said, you just have to send in a $10 money order. And I sent in seven requests under seven different names and addresses and ended up with seven pairs of tickets. So I took my friend from Columbia who lived near me in West Hempstead. He was out in LA with Sony at that time, well, Columbia at that time. So I took him and his wife, and we ended up with an extra pair of tickets we sold to somebody in line that was hoping to get them when they showed up for the club. But those shows were pretty amazing. And, you know, the final night, he only did one show, and we hung around with a bunch of other people after the show for a few hours just talking about how great it was. And my wife was out talking to Mark Brickman, the lighting guy who was hitting on her. And and she told him, he told her, hey, you know, Bruce is going to be on the cover of Time and Newsweek tomorrow. So that's, we were probably the first fans to find out about that. That night after the show, we finally then headed back to the hotel and stopped at an IHOP on, I think, Sunset Boulevard or Hollywood Boulevard. And we were in there with maybe another couple. It's probably 2 a.m. And in comes Bruce and his girlfriend and Mike Appel and his girlfriend. Bruce walks right by me, looks at me, and just kind of laughs because he had seen me in the front row every night, or at the front table every night. And I said something stupid like, are you following me around? You know.
So he did kind of know you then.
Yes. And then 2 months later, we were at Patti Smith's opening shows at the Bottom Line in New York right after Christmas. And after we did the same thing that we had done at the Roxy, and the Bottom Line had tickets to both shows. So they let us stay in the club after the first show was emptying out. So we're sitting there waiting, and we see Bruce and Karen, his girlfriend, sitting right at the front table. So I walked up to him and said, hey, Bruce, remember me from, you know, the Roxy, da, da, da. And you know, he says, yeah, hey, how you doing? I said, Bruce, I'm a desperate man. I've been running ads in the local newspapers trying to get tickets for New Year's Eve in Philly, and nobody has any. And I said, do you have any you can sell me? And I think he gave me the cocktail napkin. I don't remember what piece of paper I wrote on, but he said, hey, write your names down and I'll leave tickets for you. So,
oh, wow.
Comes New Year's Eve, it's horrible weather. And I'm working at in Fort Lee, New Jersey, right at the GW Bridge. My wife met me and we got in the car, and it's cold rain as we're heading down the Jersey Turnpike. Then it turns to sleet as we're getting, you know, midway through Jersey. And by the time we hit the Franklin Bridge going into Philly, it's snowing. And it never occurred to us, I wonder if those tickets are really going to be there. But they were. He had two tickets at the box office for us. Pretty good seats.
Oh, nice.
And so the New Year's in Philly just kind of capped it all off. Was that, you know, all his ticket prices were $5 until then, and the New Year's Eve tickets were $10 a piece. So that was a big deal. But they all had, other than Bruce, everybody had a white tuxedo on. Miami Steve was sick, I guess, to start the show, but he ended up having to bail out halfway through the show.
Now, before we get to the specifics of New Year's Eve, one of the things that took place also at the Roxy stand, and you've said we can discuss this, you taped those shows, correct?
Yes. Yeah, after the Born to Run shows, and after Jungle Land got released, I was out in Jersey getting lunch, and WNEW played a live version of Jungle Land from 1974. And I couldn't believe how great that was. I got back to my office, called in a couple of ads to the local newspapers that were in the Aquarium and the Good Times, that were in all the bars, and ran an ad saying, did somebody record this? You know, I need to get a copy. And a couple of days later, I get a call from this guy from Jersey named Joe. And he said, no, I didn't get that, but I have a bunch of tapes of Bruce that... he did radio broadcasts, and I taped some shows. And so we got together. He showed me the little recorder he used. I bought one and had that with me when I went to the Roxy. Otherwise, I wouldn't have known any better that you could do that sort of thing. And actually, all right, three of the five recordings of the Roxy, the recorder was on the stage under my blue hoodie, which we did. I had a blue hoodie just like Bruce used to wear back in those days. And had the hoodie on top of the recorder, which, you know, I just used the built-in mic. But it got, you know, decent recordings for the time.
Yeah. Yeah.
For personal use and friend trading with friends only. We never traded with bootleggers or charged any money for them.
That's the way to do it. Now,
but luckily I captured the second show on Saturday when Bruce was doing the whole bit in quarter to three about you talking to me, and reportedly De Niro and Scorsese were in the audience that night, and you talking to me became De Niro's catchphrase from Taxi Driver a year later.
Now, you were telling us earlier that you did have a little incident at the Roxy, though.
Yeah, we also took pictures. So coming into the Roxy, the second night, I had a camera bag that had a good camera at the bottom, my tape deck, and then some stuff of my wife's, and then a cheap camera at the top. So they checked bags going in. And that was the time when, they were announcing no photography during the first song. But it was weird. You never know what the rules really were. But at the Roxy, they saw the camera and they said, oh, you can't have that. We'll hold this for you. So I said, okay. Took our seats right at the front table and got my recorder going. And then started taking pictures with the good Nikon camera we had that we had borrowed from my sister-in-law. And that's when my wife said, oh, they spotted you and they're coming. And if you listen to the recording of that show, you can hear the hubbub going on with my wife talking to me. So I got the camera down and under the table, quickly got the film out. But before they got there, and then handed them the camera and said, oh, sorry, guys, I didn't know. And then after the show, went to pick up the two cameras, and he handed me the good Nikon camera. And I said to him, I bet you guys took the film out, didn't you? And he said, I knew you took it out before you gave it to me.
They knew all the tricks that you guys did.
So I didn't get great pictures from the Roxy. I've got maybe a dozen of them.
Now, getting back to New Year's Eve for a moment, that, of course, is one of the Springsteen Archive releases. And in fact, we're going to be discussing that for our subscribers next month because it's the third release and we're taking them in order.
And it's spectacular recording.
It is. And one of the things I want to ask about is the slow version of 10th Avenue that was played only at that Tower Theater stand.
I thought that was great. I've played that back many times, and I thought it was, that was one of the great things about going to see Bruce, as we all know, is, every song, has different versions. In Thunder Road, going back to the bottom line, I never knew that, he would do Thunder Road just on the piano. It got me emotional. But 10th Avenue was like that. Like, I just never expected that.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
History is complicated. The story of human progress is long, messy, and riddled with controversies big and small. On Conflicted, we dive headfirst into history's most infamous events and contentious figures. We try and untangle the good from the bad, the fact from the fiction, and the monsters from the misunderstood. Was Genghis Khan a murderous butcher or a civic pioneer? Did the Allied powers go too far in firebombing the German city of Dresden at the twilight of World War II? And how did the Marquis de Sade acquire such a sinister reputation? And was any of it true? These are just a few of the tough questions we wrestle with and investigate on Conflicted. So if you love history or just enjoy a good story, please join me, your host, Zach Cornwell, for a fascinating new topic each and every month. Conflicted, a history podcast, is available on Spotify, Apple, or wherever else you get your podcasts. I hope to see you soon.
Well, as 75 came to a close and you were looking forward to 76, there was no album coming, but he did play. I mean, he toured. As we all know, that was the lawsuit year, and he had to tour to make money. And he played a bunch of shows in Red Bank again. How did those compare to the October 75 show that you saw?
Yeah, I thought, to me, I didn't think they were quite as exciting or as good. It could be just because I had seen them so many times, you know, and they didn't change much, even though we got a few new songs. But going back just to the 75, the other great show that I was so happy to see in the archive series was CW Post College.
Right.
And there I was hanging around out front and saw Mike Appel. And went over and introduced myself and again said, hey, I'm the guy that was in the IHOP after the Roxy shows. Hopefully Bruce is going to be doing a lot more shows. And he says, well, yeah, he's got a couple of shows that aren't really publicized we're working on. But he gave me his phone number to call his office anytime to get an update. So sure enough, I called his office and found out he was playing the Choate Prep School at Wallingford, Connecticut in April and West Point Military Academy in May. And that's the only way I knew, and therefore my friends knew, that those shows were even being played, because they weren't advertised. They were, supposedly private shows for the attendees at those institutions. But the woman at Wallingford couldn't believe it when I called up and just said, can you hold 12 tickets for me? But she did, you know, and people came from New Jersey and Philadelphia, with those the promise that those tickets would be there. But we ended up with my friends and Joe from New Jersey and his friend Ernie, who brought Ed Shockey, his friend from Philadelphia. So Shockey was at that show, went back backstage to say hello to Bruce. Bruce couldn't believe that he was seeing a friendly face there.
Now, you also recorded the Palladium shows. And, I mean, you've really done such a service for the fan base, because obviously if you guys hadn't been doing this at the time, people like me and Flynn and so many other thousands of people would have never gotten to hear these shows. And they're important shows, both in the development of his career and also because they take place in this lawsuit period.
Right. Yeah. Those shows. Luckily, Joe had introduced me to one of the prominent Dylan collectors, and I got to be friends with him, and he taught me a lot of things about the higher end recording and open reel tapes. And he told me, he says, I have a friend of mine that they both wanted to get recordings of the band in September at the Palladium. And this one guy was going out of the country for a while, and he said, can I loan you my Sony 152 SD deck, the top of the line stereo recording deck of the day? And he said, could I loan that to you when you record the band shows? I said, that'd be great. And then could I keep it until the end of the month? I've got tickets for 4 Springsteen shows. And he said, yeah, that'd be great. So luckily for those shows, I had the better, a much better recorder and microphone. And those were shows where, Gary U.S. Bonds came up and sang on 2:45. And then the next night, Patti Smith came up during Rosalita. Luckily, my wife was holding the microphone while I was up at the near the stage taking some pictures. So I got pictures of both of those incidents. Not too many of Patti Smith, but that was pretty cool.
Now, one thing I'm curious about, I'm familiar with how big DAT decks were by the time you got to the 90s. How big were the were these tape recorders at this point in 76?
About a 3-inch thick Encyclopedia Britannica, and they weighed about the same.
Okay.
A good, 9 by 13 maybe.
Okay.
And then they took 6 D batteries.
That's hilarious.
And I'd used to stuff extra D batteries in my tube socks, just in case. So it was pretty heavy.
Oh wow! And then I guess security, were they more concerned with alcohol and other substances, or did they focus on that kind of thing as well?
My wife would bring a fairly big bag and throw a whole bunch of stuff on top of the recorder, so nobody bugged her all the times that we went in. But the fourth show, the first one in November, the show was she was sick, so I went in by myself and got it in. It didn't have a problem, and it had a second row seat, so I was really set up. I went in early, had the deck under my chair. And then I see a security guy with a flashlight coming around. I say, "Oh, I'm in for it." And he gets to me. He looks under my seat and he goes, "Let me look at that." And I said, "I'm sorry, it's a tape recorder." He says, "I don't care. I'm looking for bombs."
All right. Well, hey, use that to your advantage.
Security said, "Hey, no problem here." So I got a good recording of that show.
And then how big was the microphone?
The Sony mic, is maybe 8 or 10 inches long. It was just a single head that was a stereo, had one on each side of the head. So it fit inside a tube sock.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
I'm fascinated by this as well, because it's like I was just saying, you guys probably didn't recognize this at the time, that these tapes would really be around for decades. Did you ever consider that sometime 50 years later you'd be talking about the tapes that from these shows in 75 and 76?
Never imagined it.
It really is crazy if you think about it, but it has been such a gift to the fan base. And in a way, I don't know if you've ever heard from the organization or there's ever been any involvement in that capacity, but really they should be trying to get all of the masters from these tapes for their own archives to make sure that all of this is preserved.
Oh, they don't care.
They don't care?
I doubt it, but go ahead, Cliff. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, I have no reason to think that. And, there haven't been any archive releases from 76. And one of the guys that was with me in that group of 12 had a state-of-the-art recorder, great mics, sat. We all sat right. I didn't bring a recorder. I knew we were going to be, first come, first serve. So I wanted to be sitting up front, and I actually ended up sitting next to Obi. Was the first time I met Obi. So I sat right next to her in front of the stage. But the guy that wanted to record it, he was 4 rows back in the center, and he got a phenomenal recording. Gems has released it, so it's out there on Jungle Land and Greasy Lake and all. But I talked to a friend of mine that's involved in the official releases, and said, "Why in the world don't you release that Wallingford tape? It's phenomenal. The job that they did in remastering it." That's right. The friends of mine were able to track down the taper of the show. I don't want to name him, so I have no idea what he's doing these days. But they tracked him down, got the original cassettes, remastered them, and just have a phenomenal recording that people would love to be able to buy. But the friend of mine that's involved in the official production of the archive series said they'll only release stuff that's multi-tracked.
We all understand it's not going to be the best possible quality. And look, I love a good quality tape. And the archive series, as we've discussed, is an embarrassment of riches. But they really should fill in these gaps.
Yes, they would be great. It's funny, at the time when people had asked me about it, recording, and I said, "Hey, if Bruce ever releases any of these tapes I've made, I will definitely buy them. And I have since bought every single archive release. So I don't know how many hundreds that is, but that's 20. And I buy the high definition versions. So that's $20 to $25 times several hundred downloads that I've bought from Bruce. So I've put my money where my mouth is.
I would do the same thing. They release it, I'm going to buy it. So yeah. even though I have all the so many of these recordings via the magic of bootlegging or the audience versions.
Yep. And they're all great.
A show you didn't tape, but that is very, very legendary. You attended the 1977 Boston Music Hall Stand, including the final night, March 25th.
Oh, those shows.
What do you remember about that?
Those were electric. The reason I didn't tape them is my friend who recorded those shows, again, it's on all the download sites, and they've been remastered by the Gems guys. He had an in at the Boston Music Hall box office. So he was set up with third or fourth row right in front of the speakers. You know, back then, all the speakers were on the stage. So yeah, you got the sound right there. So he recorded from that location. He knew that I was taking pictures. So he set me up with third or fourth row dead center seats for the last three shows of the 77 stand. So I took hundreds of photos, many of which have been published, and one of them was a cover shot on Backstreet's magazine. Lawrence Kirsch has published several of them in his fantastic book For You, Bruce, and one of them is still on the Rolling Stone website that I captured the shtick they did. I think it was this third night. When they brought a stretcher out, Bruce, you know, faked having a heart attack and recorded a three. And they had some nurses come out with a stretcher. And he did a whole thing with, you know, falling over on the stretcher. And luckily, I captured several pictures, including one with Bruce with his eyes crossed and his tongue out. And I think that's still on the Rolling Stone website.
I mean, those are some fantastic pictures. I remember that Backstreet's issue, it had a great recollection of the 77 tour. And then about 14 months later, you were at the three shows again in Boston at the Start of the Darkness tour.
Right.
How did they kind of compare? What were your thoughts on those?
Again, you know, I can't say much bad. They were fantastic because that was Darkness on the Edge of Town stuff. And that friend of mine in Boston that taped all the shows in Boston was able to record Darkness on the radio. Boston radio station played a copy of the album 2 weeks before it was released. So he made a copy and put it in the mail to me. And I got that. The first thing I did was I heard Badlands. I immediately called up my friend Joe in Jersey and said, "You got to hear this. You can't believe it. It's unbelievable." So I played him Badlands through the phone and then was, you know, so excited to be able to come and see that stuff live. I can't remember why I recorded the first night and not the other two. But unfortunately, I got stuck in tunnel traffic for 2 hours and missed the first six songs of the May 29th show, and nobody else it was recording that. So the only version of that show is out there with six songs missing.
Oh, that's always frustrating.
We didn't have GPS back then. So there was no, we just ended up in the tunnel and just sitting there. And I was so frustrated.
Occasionally I'll talk to people who saw Bruce in the 70s and going back, and they didn't remain as big a fan as you have remained. One of the things that really struck me when we were prepping for this interview, you've continued to see Bruce regularly throughout all these decades.
Yep. You know, had a lull, you know, with two kids, had kids in 1980 and 1982. So I never saw any Tunnel of Love show, which I love that tour, but I missed those shows that, and picked up again in 92 when I could start taking my kids to the shows. So went through that whole situation of bringing the kids to their first Springsteen show and having them fall asleep or not be too interested.
How did you view those shows in comparison to, say, the ones in the 70s?
Not as special. Can't say they weren't, that they weren't as good. Certainly the band was professional, and, the 92, 93 band was exciting, and, they brought their own, talents to it. So I enjoyed the shows and kept coming back. And also, I did see a number of shows in the 80s, some of the stadium shows, but they just weren't the same as seeing Bruce, in a 3,000 or 4,000 seat hall where this, you just had the great sound. That was the, one of the earmarks of Bruce's shows, were just the incredible sound that you just didn't hear with many other bands. So as he got bigger in the 80s, wasn't as, happy with the sound as I was, having seen him in the Boston Music Hall.
As a taper, you're particularly plugged in, so to speak, to that aspect of the shows in themselves.
Yeah, luckily for the three shows at Madison Square Garden in 78, got to New York, and it was just before we moved to Florida, so it was kind of our last hurrah. That was the other reason I didn't keep up with Bruce as much, as we lived in Boca Raton, Florida through the 80s. But at Madison Square Garden, walking across 7th Avenue, I saw a guy selling tickets and went up to him and ended up with second row tickets right in front of the speakers for the first two nights for $50 a piece. So,
which I guess that was a lot of money at that time.
Yeah, well, it was still a pretty good deal.
It was worth it.
Yeah. So that was able to get two very good recordings. And as hard as it is to believe, there were 60,000 tickets sold to those three shows, and I got the only recordings.
That was going to be my next question. It sounds like you were the only one who got a recording. I don't know of any others.
Nope. I've continued to look. I download what I see out there, and everybody is, pretty much just remastering my stuff.
And I assume those did get a very proper treatment at some point with proper transfer
of them. I gave Jared Hauser, another legendary taper, mm-hmm. And collector. I loaned them to him for a while, and he did the first kind of proper transfer. And then recently I had transferred them again myself using another piece of hardware about a year ago to a fellow over in Europe. Forget what his website is, but it's like H.R. Bush or something like that. But he did a good job of, fixing up the sound and putting them out there. So there are several versions that are out and around.
Yeah, it's unfortunate that those shows, they should have had the production truck there for those, and it's surprising that they apparently have not, or did not, yep. Rather.
Just before we wrap up, I want to get your thoughts on the reunion era. I see that you saw quite a number of shows. We actually attended quite a number of the same shows when the band reunited in 99 and 2000.
Yeah, that was really special.
So you felt the magic was still there, because you went back, sure, all these years. And again, like I was saying, I've spoken to people over time where they're like, oh, we saw him in 75. It was never the same, when you guys were seeing him, but you certainly don't feel that way.
No, I think I kept an open mind to it. Similar to, I'm really surprised that a few of my friends have soured on Bruce over ticket price issues and that, that whole business last year. And, I didn't take it personally, but, we all know people that have soured on Bruce dramatically because of that. And it just, surprised me. So maybe I'm just a, you know, just have a more of an open mind and realize these things aren't going to be the same, but they can still be great. And the reunion shows were fantastic. You know, we saw three of the shows at the Staples Center when he opened Staples, and Las Vegas was an amazing show at the MGM Grand. You know, it was a fairly small venue compared to what he was doing. And then for the final four shows, I went to New York on my own. My wife had some things going on, and I got tickets for the final four shows took a bunch of my childhood friends or college friends to the shows at the Garden, and didn't do that for the last night. I had to pay $500 for a nosebleed seat, but I was sure
that was a big ticket.
I was sure glad I was there. And as you, if you guys were there, you'll remember, I had just assumed I'd be able to go out in front of the Garden and pick up some scalp tickets. But the police weren't allowing anybody to be anywhere near Madison Square Garden because of American skin.
Yeah, they were very strict about the ticket transfers outside, that's for sure, even if they were at face value.
But they wouldn't even allow people to hang around outside the Garden. It was just desolate out there. There was nobody. You weren't allowed to stand and talk.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, no, it's there were no tickets to be had there, so I had to deal with New York ticket brokers and got taken to the cleaners, but it was well worth it.
Yeah, that was a night you had to be in the building, for sure. It was really one of those very special nights that only Bruce can provide, and the very end of that show with the Blood Brothers was just such a stunning moment.
I agree.
Yeah, definitely one of my favorites, to say the least.
Well, Cliff, thank you so much for joining us. This has really been tremendous for us to hear these tales from the 70s, to hear about taping. Again, we can't thank you enough both for joining us, but also for allowing the fan base to hear these shows, because Flynn and I come into the picture long after the 70s shows took place. So we would have never heard any of this except for the very limited amount of stuff that they released over time. And now, fortunately, with the archive series, there's a significant amount more, thankfully. But, you know, becoming a fan in 1984, and we just talked about the Winterland shows, the only way I had to hear this stuff was through the magic of bootlegging.
Yeah. Well, if you ever do get to talk with Joe, thank him for returning for answering that ad in the paper and offering to give me copies of tapes that he had done, even though I had nothing at the time to share with him.
Yeah, it's been an absolute honor to talk to you. You're a legend in the Bruce world, the Bruce fan world, or at least people should recognize you as such. Those, as Hal said, those tapes you did back in the day when very few people, I mean, maybe it was just you and Joe who were doing it, and you helped so many people, increase their fanaticism about his music. That is for sure. So we thank you tremendously.
You're very welcome. Glad to do this.
Once again, that was Cliff B. sharing his amazing stories of seeing Bruce back in the mid-70s. And wow, he really makes me wish that I was a little bit older.
Really remarkable stuff. We were very lucky to have him on. And just to think what he has seen, it really is crazy. And there just aren't that many people we could talk to who would have the experience of those shows and also be that articulate in describing them. So we again, really appreciate the fact that he talked to us.
Yeah, it was incredibly humbling to talk to someone who was there, who did the taping to allow us to hear these recordings all these years later. And as I said earlier, it was such an amazing service to Springsteen fans for generations. And again, we really appreciate what he did, and we appreciate him coming on and telling us about it.
So we hope everyone enjoyed that. And with that, I'm just going to wrap things up. None But the Brave is presented by Evergreen Podcasts and produced by Bull Market Entertainment. Please check out our Patreon page for our additional offerings. We have our message board Brave Talk, and we do all sorts of additional content throughout the month. That's at patreon.com/mbtbpodcast. And of course, on Twitter, you can find us at mbtbpodcast.
So thanks once again to Cliff B for joining us, and for Hal Schwartz on Flynn McClain, saying thanks for listening, and we'll see you further on up the road.
Thank you so much. We'll be seeing you.
Hey, this is Aaron from No Simple Road. I'm inviting you to come hang out with Apple, Mel, and I as we talk with the musicians, artists, chefs, authors, and beyond from the world that turns us on. We're reaching into the improvisational music scene, the psychedelic culture, the festival world, and getting to know what makes the people tick that create those scenes. Come join us on the long, strange trip over at No Simple Road.